yet people helped each other and came through. So this is a pretty interesting set of historical background facts for someone sitting in our studio here in Keene. And I just wondering if you would tell us a little bit more about, first, I think the just generally, you know, when we're talking about the issue of health freedom, what is it that you really want people to understand, just briefly, and then I would like you to tell us a little bit more about your background, about what you're noticing in today's country and what's happening around the country in terms of people's freedoms, and how that maybe relates a little bit to what you learned when you were in the Netherlands during the Nazi occupation.
All right. Glad to be here. Health freedom basically refers to choice in choosing your doctor, your medicine, your treatments of any kind. And I didn't bring our official mission here, but that's basically what it means. And most of us think we pretty much have that choice, except when we are in managed care, we're already aware that maybe this choice is somewhat restricted. But if you look at it more closely, we'll see that choice is much more limited than we might think. To come back to my background in the Second World War, there was just an continually increasing thumbscrews were put on us in little ways. And it started with the Boy Scouts that I was a member of being forbidden, because obviously that didn't fit in the Nazi idea. But then later on in school, the textbooks that we were going to use that year were taken away, and then we got them back later on, and we found out that little pieces of paper had been glued over certain sections in the book. This was history, so we figured that's literally a rewriting of history. So, of course, we went home and tried to soak it over steam. We would hold the page to see if we could get that piece of paper off and what it actually said. And it made me very much aware at an early age of how things could be just turned in a different way to suit a particular power structure.
Indeed. That's a pretty harrowing experience to have to live through. So I imagine that gives you a frame for looking at what's happening now around this country. And before we kind of get into what's right, what's wrong, what's not working, what is working, I'm wondering if we can touch a little bit on the whole issue of freedom. And it's something that we talk about every day in our democracy. It's something that we hear President Bush and other presidents talking about every day, our elected officials. And yet there seems to be a little bit of a checkout, I think, in some people's minds in terms of, you know, what is freedom really? What is it, and what does it require of us? Is it just something that we get to take for granted, or do we actually have to do something to maintain our freedoms? And so let's talk a little bit about that, especially since we live in the live free or die state.
Yes, indeed. Without getting into deep philosophical discourse, I think that in a simple, straightforward way, we can kind of test the idea of freedom with this idea. Your freedom stops where mine starts and vice versa. And we have a pretty strong idea of that when it comes to not accepting anyone telling us what we should read or music to listen to. We would simply say, are you crazy, if somebody were to suggest that he was going to tell us what to read or what to listen to. However, in some other areas, we are a little weak. For example, MySpace and YourSpace are separate. And of course, they intersect and they interweave. But when it comes to the fact that listening to music of somebody else's choice that invades my private space, there's a problem there. I remember once on a beach in Long Island, walking over to somebody who was listening to a radio, and it was really quite loud and didn't need to be that loud. And I had in my hand what I was reading, and I said, this is a great article, you should really read this. And the guy looked at me and his eyes dropped open, and I said to him, well, you think I'm crazy that I'm asking you what to read, but it's the similar thing is, your music is not necessarily what I want to listen to at this moment too, so would you mind turning it down? The guy turned it down. I think that just about the same year later on, Jones Beach actually has a radio-free beach. But the whole idea that any music we put on in our car loudly or in a backyard should be accepted by somebody else, I think, is a weak idea of freedom. We should be continually aware that if we invade somebody else's private space unnecessarily, well, there's a problem. So I just wanted to mention that.
Mm-hmm. On that note, a lot of people might think, well, many people can't really take care of themselves, and we have such health crises in this country. Obesity is one that I can think of, and respiratory diseases is another one. Of course, heart disease is a major health crisis. And, so where do you come down on the argument of, well, people need help, and sometimes you have to guide them along, and maybe that looks like, in a way, abridging their freedom, but if we didn't do that, then we'd have worse problems down the road.
It holds to a point of you can advise them, but the whole thing of informed consent, what is it you are asking them to do or telling them to do? I think you can advise a healthy diet, you can advise a healthy way of living and lots of physical activity, but the moment you actually would begin to enforce that by saying, this is what you have to take, this is what you have to eat, this is the medicine you have to take, we are entering a different realm, and that's where personal freedom really should rule.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about, tell us now about the state of health freedom and health, I guess, in the United States?
Right. Well, to just give an example of health freedom and where I think we lost track of what it means. In any art, writing, painting, composing music, we recognize that individual choice and freedom are essential. But we do not recognize generally that healing is also an art. Two doctors may graduate from the same medical school and have the same knowledge of medical science. Let's say both will go into family medicine, yet they are likely to end up with very different approaches to healing. And those differences should be encouraged. We have a tendency in our current health establishment to discourage them and to proclaim that there is only one form of medicine, suggesting that alternate views don't measure up. And since alternate views in medicine are becoming more and more popular, it's an interesting thing to mention that recently PBS had a program on alternative medicine called The Alternative Fix. And that program was heavily slanted towards slamming down alternate medicine because the people on the panel generally were not in favor of alternate medicine. And it's just an example of a program in which the current health establishment tries to maintain the status quo. Let me give one example. 9 cities in New Hampshire have fluoridation, which was decided, according to New Hampshire law, by a majority vote in their town. There is a problem with that because fluoridation is a medical addition to the water, not for its purity, for health reasons, because it supposedly will limit dental decay. But if half of the population, or a little less than half, a slight minority, does not like it, then the vote here really enforces something on everybody that invades that private space we have been talking about. And the fascinating thing is that somehow we have gotten to come to a point that this seems to be okay and we can do these things to everybody in the general welfare, supposedly. Other countries are raising the question when asked whether they were fluoridating or not. Japan and Sweden are two examples. They mentioned, well, there's a question of freedom concerns here too. They do not fluoridate. Most of the developed world does not defluoridate. And so there's an interesting question here that is a public vote, a majority vote, a legitimate way to enforce a medical measure that many doctors, 14 Nobel Prize winners, and most of the developed world does not agree with. 98% of Europe does not drink fluoridated water. So just this whole enforcement business needs to be thought about.
Well, of course, it reminds me of the tyranny of the majority in any kind of voting that goes on in this country, especially, you know, if 49% of the people don't agree with something, somehow the 51% can tell them what to do, and how can we avoid chaos from breaking out if we give the minority his point of view? I know that's, I think, part of the, you know, part of the thought form that goes on behind, you know, that reasoning of we all have to agree on something. How can we divert a certain amount of water to your house and not have it fluoridated, and my house can be? It's one of those issues. But I happen to notice that that Canada actually has come out with actually for several years now. Here's a quote here I'm reading: citizens should think twice about putting fluoride in the water because the practice has minimal benefits and some risk, suggesting a newly released government report by the Ontario, I guess, Commission of Health. And it says in small and absolute terms, often not statistically significant and may not be of clinical significance, is what they're saying about the effects of fluoridated water. So, I mean, there's two issues here. There's, you know, there's the actual research that says this is not good, or perhaps at least not helpful, and then there's the issue of you know, how we work this out on a collective level and use our voting power to enforce our will on others, or to have others' wills enforced on us. So tell me a little bit, since we're here on the issue of fluoridation, can you give our listeners a little bit of background about this whole fluoridation debate? When did it start, and what is the controversy?
I don't want to carry this one too far, since we want to get to many, many other things too. And fortunately, we do not have fluoridation in the Monadnock area, because citizens here had the wisdom to vote it out when it came up for a vote. But it came up in the 1940s, after the Second World War, and long-range safety studies were cast overboard. Somehow it became a bandwagon kind of phenomenon, where those studies were stopped and everybody jumped on board that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it should go forward. There was considerable scientific solid questioning and opposition, but it was somehow swept by the wayside. And there is a new book that came out in last year, in 2004, by Christopher Bryson, an investigative journalist, called The Fluoride Deception. And I highly recommend it. I've given a copy to the Keene Library, so you can go and get it there. It reads like a detective novel, but is very solidly based on facts that are fully documented in the book. And there are some surprising revelations in there about a kind of collusion between government scientists and industry lawyers who were afraid of fluoride lawsuits, because fluoride is used in all kind of industrial processes, and somehow working together with a dental group to promote fluoridation. And ultimately, the phenomenon happened, I think, in the 60s, that when a fluoride lawsuit, an industrial lawsuit, workers that had been damaged by fluoride, and came forward in the courts, the lawyer defending the industry could pull a fluoride tube out of its office and say, well, look, if this is so great for kids, how could that possibly be as bad as they describe here? So it played an important role in a way that most people are totally unaware of. I highly recommend the book. The one thing that one should not forget in this discussion is that there is not an open discussion. The fluoride promoters consistently refuse to have a scientific forum discussion of the issue. When the EPA last year, in 2003, invited people from both sides in a scientific forum to discuss the issue, nobody turned up to speak for fluoridation. Happened in several other scientific forums. It happened in Manchester before it was came to a vote in September. Nobody could be found to speak for fluoridation in an open forum, public forum. I believe when that is the case, all of us should begin to wonder what is wrong here.
So not only did they not vote, but there's a couple of communities out there that did not even have the opportunity to even say whether they wanted it.
Well, the those most of those communities were included last summer, and the health establishment did a marvelous job of promoting fluoridation in such a way that the actual voices, that the actual facts that would make one think twice about voting for this, never really had a chance to come forward. And by not appearing at an invitation for a forum where a scientist was ready to debate fluoridation with a, you know, a pro-fluoridation scientist, the media did not actually pick up what the big question marks are. And so they won the vote in Manchester, but there are two communities still excluded, Auburn and Derry, for some reasons. That whole business is still in court. And the whole ballot language in New Hampshire, namely adding fluoride, is a total misnomer, because there are choices in what you put in the water, and it makes a big difference. What goes into the water in most cities in New Hampshire is hydrofluorosilicic acid, which comes straight from the pollution scrubbers from the fertilizer industry in Florida, untreated, and has contaminants in it, such as arsenic and lead. And this whole issue is not known to people. We tried to bring it forward along the, when we had the Manchester campaign going, but the media have just generally not picked up on this. This is also in court, because ultimately, if exactly is described in the ballot what is going in the water and what the choices are, I think it'll make a big difference to people, because there's a white powder that is used in some of the smaller towns, sodium fluoride, that seems to be less damaging than the hydrofluorosilicic acid. And the whole fact that we as consumers should have an informed choice when we vote on something, even if you're for it, you should know what it costs, you should know what is being put in. So in the future, there are some developments in this direction to be expected that will help.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a little break now, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Gerhard a little bit more about what's facing the citizens of New Hampshire in terms of risks to their health freedom. So we'll be right back.
When it comes to travel, nothing is as trendy as our own history. The Travel Industry Association reports that over 80% of vacationers look for historic U.S. sites to visit. And history can have its own meaning. Hampton Inn has launched a website to connect travelers to the kind of places that aren't found in textbooks, like where the first hamburger was served, or the stage where Elvis made his first appearance. The site called www.hamptonlandmarks.com will definitely provide ideas off the beaten path.
All right, Groove Cookies and Spoofers, Goofers, Aficionados. Every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., you can groove and laugh with Michelli's Vixolodian Muse, a fine hump day blend of comedy and jams. So giggle and snicker, but keep your hands on the wheel and...
May the boss be with you always!
Okay, now we return to Oasis Forum. My guest in the studio is Gerhard Betting. He is a science writer, a former teacher, a local citizen activist who is with the New Hampshire Citizens for Health Freedom, and with the Audubon Society, the Orem Foundation, Manana Freedom Forum, and the list goes on, it seems, Gerhard.
But not the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club.
I'm sorry, the Sierra Club, my mistake. And so what is the... What is the state of the health in the United States right now? What should we be looking for? What should we be concerned about? What are the indicators?
Well, the U.S. medical system has strengths and weaknesses. Let me start out to make very clear that when it comes to emergency medicine, when it comes to special technical innovations, the U.S. has done a great job. I have had two cataract operations. I probably would not be able to read or drive a car without that, and I'm deeply grateful for that. But when it comes to healing chronic illnesses, about using drugs and letting all kind of side effects actually make people get worse off than they were before, we are not doing well. I just want to mention a few statistics here that are really of interest. The World Health Organization ranked the countries of the world in terms of overall health performance. And the U.S. was, well, you want to guess how far down? 37th. And in fairness of health care, we are 54th. And yet we spend more per capita for health care than any other nation in the world. The U.S. and South Africa are the only two developed countries in the world, and South Africa to me is not very developed, that the two countries that do not provide health care for all their citizens. Lack of health insurance coverage causes 18,000 unnecessary American deaths a year. U.S. childhood poverty now ranks 22nd, or second to last, among developed nations. Second to last, childhood poverty. Only Mexico scores lower. The United States is 41st in the world in infant mortality. Cuba scores higher. Women are 70% more likely to die in childbirth in America than in Europe. Those are a couple of things that should really concern us.
I mean, I just find myself shaking my head when you say those things, because I think if you asked your average person on the street, they'd say, no, we're really at the top. We're really at the top of the heap. But that suggests there's some severe problems and that have probably been going on for a long time. So what do you say to, you know, what do you say to get the attention of your average citizen who may not be aware of this or who glazes over when you talk about those kind of statistics?
I'm leading to the point, after saying some kind things about the health system, to get people to an awareness that our present health system is simply rotten to the core. Now, understand me well. There are lots of wonderful doctors who are doing the best they can, but when it comes to the information they get, when it comes to the National Institute of Health, to the leaders in our health establishment, I will document to you that the situation is rotten to the core.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what I should get to next. Let me mention one more little stat about whether that we are clearly not number one in health in the world. U.S. hospital medical errors kill 195,000 annually. And that's about twice as much as was estimated in 1999. That is the equivalent of a loaded jumbo jet crashing every other day during the year. And I think people should realize that things are not as rosy as they would like them to be.
So what do you say, Gerhard, to someone who, you know, says, well, you know, we may not have health care for everybody, but, you know, in places like Canada and elsewhere, you know, people who are on, you know, the social health care system have really a lower, you know, lower level of health, less choices, and that sort of thing. They, you know, there's the argument that you hear coming up all the time that we wouldn't want to go to another system because it's worse. Why does that perspective prevail, and what can be done to countervail that?
That's a huge subject.
Well, we can maybe take just a short answer.
Yeah. I think we're getting very biased information about how the way one single payer systems work in other countries. I would be the first one to say that I'm sure that single payer systems are not necessarily ideal anywhere, but I do believe they would be one great step ahead compared from where we are now, because the great cost per capita for healthcare in this country is basically caused by all the insurance systems that are pushing lots of paper around. There's something extremely straightforward and simple about a single payer system that saves lots of money. And I think that other countries are in the area of 9 to 10% of their total expenditures on health, while we have about between more than 14%, and there's a 5% difference there that is probably cost by the unbelievable amount of money that goes into shoveling paper and paying insurance systems and people checking on all kinds of things.
Well, actually, I remember when Dennis Kucinich was here in Keene during during the primaries, and he was talking also about the single-payer system, and he was talking about how the current healthcare system, one of the reasons for the bloat in the budget is because A lot of that money goes into pay for marketing and promotion and also executive salaries of you know, competitive companies. And then when we make things competitive, we actually make them a whole lot more expensive.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd love to try to back up what I just said about the state of our current U.S. medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And the term corrupted to the core really fits, and I will back that up. Recently, on one of our health institutes, the National Cholesterol Education Panel, which is under the auspices of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, came out with new recommendations for cholesterol, and everybody should be watching that, because according to this panel, lots of people should be taking statins, which reduce cholesterol, because their cholesterol is too high. Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, MD, took a look at these studies and took a look at the committee. And he says, quotation marks, "Surprise, surprise, it turns out that every single member of this panel, the NCEP panel, had close association with statin manufacturers and had been paid varying huge sums of money by them." So there's a blatant conflict of interest of every panel member. And everyone chosen for the panel was in favor of prescribing statins. It would have been quite possible to create a balanced panel. There are excellent authorities such as Dr. Uwe Ravenskopf, MD, who has written a book called The Cholesterol Myths. But that panel was totally unbalanced, and every single one was paid. Now, Dr. Kendrick compares this situation that seems to, it has existed for years, and it's more and more coming to the fore, and we should just not tolerate it any longer. He compares it and says, supposing there was a lawsuit, and the judge who is going to judge this lawsuit has been paid $1 million by Microsoft, who is, you know, the defendant.
That's right.
Would we tolerate that? But the judges in this case were telling us that we all should have lower cholesterol. Each one of them is totally and utterly biased and is being paid huge. In other words, you don't need to really much more than this to see that changes are urgently needed. And I like to top off this saying. I like to mention just that the latest note I saw makes the previous thing almost ridiculous, because in Europe, in just a few weeks ago, I think, or toward the end of last year, in a huge inter-heart study presented at the European Society of Cardiology in Munich, all the causes of heart disease were listed. And they include lots of things we know, you know, alcohol and smoking and obesity and stress and high blood pressure. But the list does not include cholesterol. It's not even mentioned. And here in the U.S., we have merely this panel advising that we all should have lower cholesterol, which, by this huge international study, is shown to be not an important factor in heart disease.
Wow, that's actually pretty astounding. So, yes. If I'm understanding this correctly, you're saying that in Europe, they've now recognized that cholesterol is not an important factor in heart disease?
That's basically the conclusion. It's not even listed as one of the causes in this latest study.
Mm-hmm. So who watches the judges? Who gets to, you know, be the witness for the people who aren't policing themselves? What is it that needs to happen?
I think that there has to be a huge reaction, a populist reaction, against the kind of biased information on health we have been getting in this country. There's this sense that the U.S. is number one. Well, we shot that down earlier, but the whole idea, we are kind of insulated from the rest of the world, and it's time for us to really open up things and to see that there's a wide variety of views by reputable, credentialed scientists and doctors that should be taken into account. Mm-hmm. And to have just one power group basically dictate their views to the rest and also rake in lots of money from the drug companies is simply not tolerable.
I'd like to read just a little bit of something that's similar that brings up the same theme of our National Institutes of Health kind of falling off of the job. This is from NotMilk.com, Robert Cohen, on the consequences of genetically engineered milk. He says, 11 years ago, the greatest controversy in FDA history began with a lie when the Clinton White House, on executive branch report on RBGH, February 9, 1994, concluded that BGH, that's bovine growth hormone, treated milk is safe because it is indistinguishable from normal milk. The drug manufacturer Monsanto hired ex-Surgeon General C. Everett Koop to compound the lie. Koop's press release, dated February 6, 1994, says milk from cows given supplemental bovine somatotropin is the same as any other milk. Unfortunately, a few fringe groups are using misleading statements and blatant falsehoods as part of a long-running campaign to scare consumers about perpetuation of insulin-like growth factor, IGF-I, in the cow's milk. Levels of IGF increase in milk after cows are treated with RBGH. That's the National Institutes of Health assessment in December 1990. Then Science magazine reported in 1998 a strong positive association was observed between IGF-I levels and prostate cancer risk. The Lancet reported in the same year that insulin-like growth factor is thought to have a role in breast cancer. The Journal of National Cancer Institute in 1999 reported that high plasma levels of IGF-I, were associated with an increased risk of lung cancer. Plasma levels of IGF-I are higher in patients with lung cancer and control subjects. And it goes on and on. So you have, you know, in one year you have the Institute kind of producing research that says one thing, but, you know, 2 years later when something in a different field, and we have to note that this is commercially viable, you know, products that are created by Monsanto or others, when these come up for review, all of a sudden, what happens to those research reports? What happens to the general outcry? And who's going to be there watching the people that are supposed to be watching out for us?
Right. The influence of the large pharmaceutical companies and companies like Monsanto on these processes are very disturbing, and that is a very large part of the problem. That really needs to be addressed. The whole question of genetic engineering, I just want to mention additionally that genetically engineered food was snuck up on us, kind of sneaking into the back door without really clear, open scientific discussion. Somehow government and the industry decided together that this was nothing to worry about, which does not represent the view of many, many scientists that have been looking at genetically engineered food and the growth hormone in milk, etc. Other countries are actually refusing, Europe refuses to accept genetically engineered food from us. And that is another area where consumers should insist that genetically engineered food be labeled. Large part, something between, I think, 60 and 75% of our foods on the shelves may have some degree of genetically engineered food in it. Again, this just is pushed over on us without adequate scrutiny.
Indeed. We're going to go to a brief break here. I want to remind our listeners that if you'd like to call in and ask Gerhard Bedding any questions about health freedom, you can do that at 358-8863. If I don't pick up the phone right away, just keep let it ring for a bit because I may be in the middle of speaking. But please, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask them, give us a ring here, and we will join you back in just a second.
Keeping healthy year-round. An important way for you to stay healthy is to be up to date with vaccinations. Anytime is a smart time to think about immunizations. It's not just about going back to school or preparing for flu season. It's 24/7 because vaccines save lives and reduce illness and disability. Throughout the year, the National Partnership for Immunization asks people of all ages, are you up to date? Vaccinate. For more information, contact your healthcare provider or visit www.partnersforimmunization.org.
Well, On that note, Gerhard.
Well, it was very interesting. These things are programmed. They are not part of our program. We hadn't gotten to vaccinations yet.
And I was just going to ask you, can we talk about vaccinations? But I guess I didn't have to. But there we have, an example of this is the right thing to do. We have your best interests in mind. This is what everybody does. And why should we think otherwise?
Right. Well, there are many, many good reasons. I'd like anyone who would like to look into this further to investigate some websites. www.909shot.org is the website of the National Vaccine Information Center, which has very balanced information from experts, from doctors. There are books that you should be aware of, such as What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Vaccinations, which you can, paperback you can get in any bookstore. There's a lot to look at here, because basically in the area of vaccinations, it is clear that a certain amount of children, and a sizable amount of children, for a genetic reason probably, but we don't know exactly what it is, can be hit by vaccines where others are not. And we don't seem to have the interest to actually pursue this further so that those children can be not be harmed. And there's a lot to look at here. It is an example of something that has dogmatically come forward in such a way that you have a public service announcement like it just happened. Let me just mention to you an article here called A User-Friendly Vaccination Schedule by Donald Miller, MD, who is a cardiac surgeon and professor of surgery at the University of Washington, Seattle, and has all kinds of great credentials. He is bringing forward all the doubts and problems there are about vaccines and certain vaccines, and finally comes with a recommendation at the end of his article for parents to have the courage to make up their own mind. And this is what he recommends, and it's very different from what you just heard here in that public service announcement. Here is a vaccination schedule that I would recommend, says Dr. Miller. No vaccinations until a child is 2 years old. No vaccines that contain thimerosal, mercury. For instance, the flu vaccine now recommended for children still has mercury in it. No live virus vaccines. These vaccines to be given one at a time, listen to that. Nowadays they often give 7 or 8 at a time. Every 6 months, beginning at age 2. And then he mentions the pertussis, acellular pertussis, diphtheria, tetanus, and polio. American children are the most highly vaccinated kids in the world, he says. This schedule is an alternative to the ones that rules our vaccine nation. In contrast to the CDC's immunization schedule, it is user-friendly. There's just one view on a different view on vaccines. There are others such as Dr. Philip Nkeo, who have mentioned that in their practice, a holistic doctor, he had as many children that were not vaccinated as were vaccinated, and over 25, 30 years of practice had a good chance to compare them. And he said, and I don't have the exact words, but I get them to anyone who would like them, that by any standard, comparing the health of the two kinds of children, those that had not been vaccinated or had very few vaccinations done later, compared with those that followed the official schedule, the health of those whose parents really had taken things in their own hand was just over the whole range clearly better.
Really? The health of people who were not vaccinated was better than those that were vaccinated?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty astounding.
There is a lot to learn here, and I'm not here to... I have just done a lot of reading. I'm not here to recommend one view over another. Dr. Miller advises some vaccines, as you can see, but in a very different schedule than the official one. And I think we should, parents should wake up to the fact that that they are their children's advocates, and that unless they take a look at this closely and make up their own minds, the time has come where you just can't necessarily trust your doctor as we always used to do, because not because there's something evil in the doctor, but because the information that this doctor has grown up with and that is around us has become very dogmatic, very one-sided, and does not allow for different views.
So is it true that it's illegal in some areas to withhold your child from vaccination?
Almost all states have either a philosophical, have a religious exemption that parents can fill out and for their children. Here in New Hampshire, we have that religious exemption. There are some states that have, about 16 states, also have a philosophical exemption. Here in New Hampshire, the religious exemption can be used by parents and is used by parents who want to do it differently from the official schedule. They do not have to belong to a particular religion to use this. It has nothing to do with what church you go to. It is a personal religious view. And on the website that we are developing, New Hampshire Citizens for Health Freedom website, within a few weeks, it's under construction still, you will get very full information on this. And you may want to look at it in a few weeks. That is going to be www.newhampshirehealthfreedom.org. So parents who have not considered this before, I encourage them to take a look at this, to look at the website I mentioned. And also, you're very welcome to call me. I can give you more sources of information. My number is locally here, 603-355-2202. It is a very important area for parents to look at.
Thank you. So it sounds like what you're saying here, tell me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a combination of personal things that you can do about making different health choices, ways that you can work with your doctor to perhaps bring alternative information to him and say, hey, or her, and say, you know, I've learned about this, and I'm concerned enough to want to make you aware. And then you're also saying that we need to, you know, stand up collectively and shout, as it were, and say that, you know, what's happening in the National Institutes of Health or the FDA or other places, we need to have some other kind of response. Can you say more about what your average citizen can do and what is being done, you know, besides what you're talking about with the New Hampshire Citizens Health?
There's a national health freedom movement also that is expanding and has some excellent people working in it. It's more and more widely recognized that something needs to be done here, and that the power structure in our current health establishment needs to be looked at. We have a couple of people in Congress. We have a medical doctor in Congress, Dr. David Weldon from Florida, who has courageously come forward in questioning the health establishment, in warning the CDC not to go ahead with a whitewash of the mercury in vaccines that actually took place this last year. And the whitewash nevertheless took place. There's also been a whitewash of mercury in amalgam and dental amalgam. The power structures we have are very strong, very established, deeply rooted, and it is time for lots of people to ask questions, to question authority, and it's a question of personal courage. There is a great deal to look at, and we are living in a time when the individual, really individual consciousness, individual choice is extremely important. And realize that there are lots of good professional speakers and writers on both sides of this question. The whole thing is we hear only one side.
There has been another development over the last few years, and that's in the area of psychological freedom, what should we call that, or mind freedom. And apparently President Bush has come out with a couple of new initiatives about getting every American in some way tested for mental illness. This is from Intervention Magazine, August 8th, last year. It says, next month, President Bush plans to unveil a broad new mental health plan called the New Freedom Initiative. Speaking of freedom. And can you tell us, you know, what is at issue here, and why should we be concerned about this?
Our concern should be an incredible invasion of Big Brother, because the idea of having this mental screening for every child, and who knows, later on for every adult, I mean, you know, you're just going to be certified okay or not. And if you're not certified okay, according to which particular, you know, psychiatrists or psychological viewpoints, then obviously there's something wrong with you. And to fit into this society, you better start taking the following drugs. It is a total scandal, for example, how many children in this country are on Ritalin or similar drugs. There are excellent doctors like Dr. Peter Bruggen. Talking Back to Ritalin is a book that he has written. Parents whose children are advised to take this should really be aware of an incredible controversy around this. This is like another step in the same direction. And, of course, the pharmaceutical companies are watering at the mouth with this kind of health screening, because you could see there's another market opening up of some kind of drugs that would supposedly keep us mentally healthy. It's an incredible invasion, Big Brother invasion.
I'm noticing here in an article in the British Medical Journal, the author shows that many of the companies who helped to launch the Texas version of this, called the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, or TMAP, were also major contributors to Bush's reelection funds. For example, Eli Lilly manufactures olanzapine. This is one of the drugs recommended in the New Freedom Plan. Lilly has numerous ties to the Bush administration, according to the British Medical Journal. It says that George Herbert Walker Bush was once a member of Lilly's board of directors, and our current President Bush appointed Lilly's chief executive officer, Sidney Torrell, as member of the Homeland Security Council. 82% of Lilly's 1.6 million in political contributions, 82% of the 1.6 million went to Bush in 2000, to Bush and the Republican Party. So this is more of what you were talking about earlier, about people on the payola. And of course, now we, on a somewhat different subject, but it's the same idea of now that there has been information to come out that the Bush administration paid off various radio personalities and journalists to forward their point of view. And this is happening with the Social Security Administration. It really seems to be a major breakdown happening. So,
but I'd like to just attach a footnote to what you said, because the whole question of the pharmaceutical companies and their influence on politicians goes across both parties. And there's just, I don't think that the situation would necessarily be much improved or different if we did not have the current administration. The health freedom question and the pharmaceutical influence is so deeply ingrained that basically we have corporations running the world, and the pharmaceutical ones are some of the big ones that that are running our world.
So besides what we talked about earlier, what's a person to do, especially on the national level? What would you advise a person to do on some of these larger issues?
There's only so much each one can do, and there seems to be just a plethora of issues around all the time. But start locally. Think if there is such a group in New Hampshire, like the New Hampshire Citizens for Health Freedom, and you have what has been said this evening somehow has stirred you up, why not send them $10 a year and become a member and support what they are doing? And then the next step might be to look at what national freedom, health freedom organization, one that I would recommend looking at is Citizens for Health. At this moment, I don't have the website in front of me, but if you type it into Google, just Citizens for Health, you'll get it easily. They are an excellent group. Many of us do not have the time to personally get that deeply involved in any one issue, but it should be possible for us to at least support those groups, that grassroots groups that are working towards ameliorating this situation.
So we just have a few minutes left here. I noticed you have a quote from the New Religion Medicine. I don't know if you wanted to read that to our listeners or whether you had any other, you know, comments. Or I can read it if
you. I have a couple of quotes.
Go ahead.
There's one by Representative Ron Paul in Congress, who was also an MD. He says, "When we give government the power to make medical decisions for us, we, in essence, accept that the state owns our bodies." And let me see what I can see.
And I've got this New Religion.
Okay, the religion.
Yep. Go ahead.
New Religion Medicine from the website, the Center for Unhindered Living. The United States was formed to ensure religious freedom for all. As a result, a person can participate in any chosen form of religion or choose not to participate in religion at all. However, there is a new religion, an institutionalized religion, which every person is expected to participate in. If a person chooses not to participate in these institutionalized rituals, they are often subject to ridicule, harassment, and even legal action. You know that a parent can't, if they do not give certain vaccines, and they may not have done the religious exemption, that action can be taken. If a person chooses not to allow their children to participate in these institutionalized rituals, they're often subject to legal action, and in some instances even have their children taken away from them. This is the way of the new religion, medicine. And then the same article goes on about faith in the medical model of healing, and it identifies the medical model as saying that the things that make a person sick come from outside a person. Bacteria, viruses, fungi, all enter the body and make a person sick. That basically is our view. And so then getting well is only a matter of killing the organism which infected the person. Holistic medicine and holistic health care has a different view and really trying to get to the causes and realizes that the particular bacteria or virus that might invade your body, first of all, needs to have an environment in that body that is willing and ready to accept it. And that has to do with your immune system. And so the whole question of thinking and becoming healthier has much to do with how can we build a better immune system in us and in our children, as probably the best investment in health that will not make it necessary to use all kind of drugs later on to just work on symptoms.
Well, we want to really thank you for being here tonight on our second show and giving us a lot of enlightening things to think about. I'm sure people have all kinds of responses, disbelief, perhaps anger, perhaps sadness, maybe a little bit of outrage. And, you know, it's our point here to point you to new ways of looking at things and new ways of responding to what's out there in the world. If you want to visit our website, I'll give it to you a little bit later. We'll have a few of these URLs that Gerhard has mentioned. So we want to thank you for being here, Gerhard Benning. He's a local science writer and a former teacher and on the board and very active with many local nonprofit organizations. And we certainly look forward to future reports and seeing how these things are coming down the pike as more people get informed. So thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And now we will be going into a break shortly. Let me... here we go. So thanks for joining us for this hour of Oasis Forum. For more information or suggest topics for the show or other guests, please write oasis_wknh@hotmail.com. That's oasis_wknh@hotmail.com. Or visit http://tinyurl.com/64YLP. That's http://tinyurl. That's TINYURL.com/64YLP. Next week, we'll be back at 7 p.m. for an interview with Peter Alexander, Executive Director of New England Coalition in Brattleboro, Vermont, which promotes safe, renewable energy alternatives. This is John Michael Dumais, your host for Body, Mind, Spirit Oasis. Stay tuned with us here, and in just a couple of minutes, we'll be starting our second hour called Oasis Journeys with food for the heart, mind, and soul.